House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water will come to order.
The Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources will come to order.
For staff, I would note that we now need to get these tables installed down in the other ones. Yeah, love that. Colleagues, we have a joint committee today on an informational hearing on the 10-year energy plan. I'd like to call up Michael Jung. Happy to see so many people in the audience for an informational hearing. And look forward to your presentation. And we will take, we understand that some folks have caucus at 2:30. So, Mr. Jung, if you could keep your initial remarks relatively brief, we will hopefully have some time for questions from those that need to leave. And then committee, for those that would like to stay, we can keep going. Mr. Jung.
Thank you, Co-Chair Bailey, Co-Chair Gilliam, Senate Vice Chair Olson. It's a privilege to be here this afternoon to brief you and update you on the progress of the Governor's 10-Year Energy Plan Task Force work. My name is Michael Jung. I serve as the volunteer chair for the Governor's Energy Planning Task Force. We are here in our final week of our efforts. On Friday, the Governor has set a deadline for us to deliver a report born out of some, we started in late October, so 4 months of decidedly swift effort. The process I have described, I believe, for both committees at this point, but I'll quickly recap. There are 5 design teams. They have been populated with about 35 volunteer participants. The design teams are as follows. There is a consumption side design team that we call energy efficiency and demand management. There is a supply side design team that we call resource mix. There is a dedicated design team for siting issues. There is a design team for transportation. And the fifth design team is less about energy substance and more about energy governance. And the governance design team is populated in particular with the 3 vice chairs of our effort. I guess I'll go ahead and tell you that the EEDM, the consumption side team, is chaired by Susan Ackerman, who you probably know from her role in the PUC. The supply side team is chaired by Rachel Shimshack, who you might recognize from the Renewable Northwest Project. The siting team is chaired by Dave Stewart-Smith, who has previously worked on siting issues here in the state government. And the transportation design team is chaired by John Reese, who serves as a city manager in the city of Eugene. And the governance design team has no chair. It has 3 individuals who all serve as vice chairs for the overall energy task force. And those individuals are Roy Hemingway, who you may remember from his long service across 3 different governors' administrations, as well as his role in the PUC, as well as being a founding father of the Northwest Power Planning and Conservation Council, as it's now known. And Kevin Lynch, who works at Iberdrola Renewables, the second largest operator of renewable power projects around the country. So we are fortunate to have enormously talented and deeply experienced individuals. The folks that I have named are just examples of the kind of depth and breadth that we have in our ranks. We have been clear from the beginning in this process that the participants are not there as representatives of their respective organizations. The participants in our design teams are there based solely on the merits of their individual talents, their personal experiences, their professional qualifications. They are not there to advocate for the organizations that employ them. Indeed, we have given them explicit instructions consistently at every meeting that they are to take their stakeholder hats off and put their thinking caps on. And I'm pleased to say that with great consistency, we have seen this succeed. I can't tell you how many times I've been pleased by design team participants, starting off statements by saying things like, you might be surprised to hear this from me, but, or, you know, I never thought I'd find myself saying this, however, prefacing their statements, getting outside of their natural comfort zones, and moving forward with bigger, bolder ideas than they might otherwise in their day-to-day jobs. I've been very pleased with this. The design teams submitted their final reports to the governor, or to the task force, on February 2nd of this year. Those reports from the five different design teams have been integrated over this past month in an integration process. We have an integration team that is populated by participants from the governor's policy staff, as well as representatives from the design teams, one or two people from each design team, along with the three vice chairs and myself. The integration team has met weekly for several hours at a time. The emails have been fast and furious, and I'm pleased to report that in this past month of meetings, I think we've made some very good progress. We are confident that we will be able to deliver a report to the governor, advising him on options, actions that he may take for Oregon's next 10 years of energy. Going forward, the governor's office, I am told, is planning to deliberate for a couple of weeks, I think 3 weeks is on the schedule, to consider these recommendations, ultimately to take ownership of some of them, hopefully a lot of them, and present a governor's energy plan forward at the end of March. I believe March 26th is the calendar date scheduled for this, to the public. This will be introduced with the intent of stakeholder consultation, review, and comment. The exact process is still in development for the stakeholder process. We anticipate that there will be certainly a written comment and review option, as well as there will be outreach, a roadshow, if you will, that will travel around the state, that will engage communities and citizens close to home so that they can come out and see it and hear it in person. The stakeholder period right now is scheduled for about a six-week period. And along the way, there will be efforts to consolidate and deliberate on the comments received along the way, as well as at the end, there will be an additional couple of weeks where the governor will consider all of the input that he's received from the Oregonian public and ultimately take ownership of a finalized governor's energy plan at the beginning of the summer. With that, I'll conclude my remarks and open it up to questions.
Thank you, Mr. Jung. Questions for Mr. Jung?
Mr. Chair.
On the Senate side.
Co-Chair Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. We okay? Go ahead.
Here.
Sure. First of all, I want to thank the Senate Committee for coming and also my colleagues for showing up at two instead of three. As Mr. Jung, you can imagine how busy this week is, but the fact that we're all here, the fact that the folks behind you are here, shows you how interested we are in the work that you're doing. I'm going to ask you a couple of questions because we have some anxiety. We're not as much eager as I think we are maybe anxious about the report. But I want you to understand that I appreciate your service. I appreciate the conversation we had in my office. And I'm bearing in mind that you are a volunteer and working hard with the charge that the task force has given you. You may have answered this, but I want just a little clarity. In the way that you're working, I understand and appreciate asking folks to take off their stakeholder hats. But now that, you know, we're just about to unveil the report, the first final report, or if that's a correct term, I'm interested in when we put our stakeholder hats back on. And the end of my question is this. Is there going to be ample opportunity for stakeholders who are very anxious about this to have their input and when, as opposed to not opposed to, but different than the public input? Can you talk a little bit about that? Because particularly utilities and others are very eager and anxious to be part of the process.
Thank you for the excellent question. The stakeholder outreach, I would characterize as having already begun in many ways. We have, in the same spirit of my coming here today to brief the joint committees, we have been sitting down with members of the stakeholder community to bring them up to speed on the process as it's unfolded so far. In the same way that I'm not able to tell you what's going to be in the final report because the report is not yet final, we have not been able to tell the stakeholder what all is in those final reports. I can share with you particular tidbits. One thing worth noting that I did not get to cover was that the first drafts of the design teams received some feedback from the governor's policy advisory staff. That feedback identified three cross-cutting themes that the design teams were instructed to go back and dig deeper into. Those three themes were technology and innovation. What roles can technology and innovation play in our energy future over the coming 10 years? The second was carbon and climate. It's difficult to imagine talking about energy in the context of a 10-year horizon without talking about or addressing climate and carbon. in that context. And the last was identifying ways for communities, neighborhoods and communities, townships and counties around the state to become models, first movers, early adopters in this energy plan. There was tremendous enthusiasm around the idea that, as the science fiction writer William Gibson once wrote, the future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed yet. Figuring out a way that we can help communities around the state become first movers in actionizing the Energy Action Plan so that they can start pushing on one or two or three particular areas, particular proposals, and showing us the way forward, identifying the things that we, you know, mistakes that we don't want to repeat, and helping the rest of the state to do the things the right way by doing them the first time around. So those were three cross-cutting themes that were of particular interest, and the design teams have basically assembled little joint committees between themselves to populate these. The design teams, as you can imagine, have only had 3 or 4 weeks to come over and, you know, come together and think about these very big issues. I would say that, you know, as a general theme, the expectation should be that this energy plan will be decisive as opposed to comprehensive in its recommendations. It will be it will propose items that will have either the greatest impact or be the most immediately actionable. It will not cover all of the bases, nor does it intend to do so. There are many things that we can do on energy that we might not necessarily do from day one. We might save some of these things for, you know, further down the road towards year 10. But setting ourselves up for success, as opposed to trying to do it all at once, will certainly be the kind of, you know, take that the energy plan will have going forward. The stakeholder outreach, just off the top of my head, sir, if I may, we've sat down with folks from tomorrow will be a session with the county commissioners, there's been a session with the Oregon Business Association. We've sat down with the labor unions, and we've sat down with some of the customer-owned utilities around the state and their representatives. So we have been sitting down with, I have been sitting down with these groups and engaging them to the extent that I can at this point. And going forward, there will be a lot more engagement. We have already just today given instructions to the design team participants who have done, you know, the heavy lifting so far, that they should now prepare to put their stakeholder hats back on. And we've given them very clear instruction that their job is not to be cheerleaders, but their jobs are to be critics. Their job is to make this plan better and to do it all together from the outside in now that they're done with the heavy part of their work.
I can't, Mr. Chair. I don't want to dominate this, but I want to quickly follow up and say, but I'm still eager, and if this is not something that you're charged with or no, but I'm still eager to find out when those times will be and in what format. I think all of us would enjoy, for instance, I was just listening to Representative Boone, all of us would enjoy your comments about the design teams themselves, who was on those and so forth, in a list. I don't think we have any written or, I'm looking at
you, Beth. You don't have it in front of you, but I can provide you with that.
Okay.
Yes, that information is available off the Oregon Department of Energy website, along with the charge documents that were basically starting instructions for each design team. I can certainly share that link with the members of
but
this.
I think everybody's eager to, and which leads into what my actual follow-up is, Mr. Chair, and that is the department. To the extent that you know, can you speak a little bit to what the design teams may have in mind for the engagement of the department, given its strange situation? Right now in state government.
If by department you're referring to the Department of Energy.
I am.
I can tell you at this point that the current status quo is not viewed upon as being an acceptable arrangement for implementing the recommendations that will come out of this energy plan. There is recognition that the capacity is incommensurate with the need. There is a recognition that the breadth of action that needs to be taken outstrips the responsibilities with which that department is currently entrusted. There is recognition that the department has had highs and lows, now is perhaps more of a low than a high, most would agree, and that continuing with this institutional arrangement would do injustice to the energy plan as it's envisioned through its proposals. The governance proposal, there are nuances in there that I can't go into detail on quite yet, but I can tell you that it does recommend change in the way the Department of Energy is structured, and those changes are contemplated with actionizing those recommendations that have come out of the design teams in mind.
Thank you.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Michael, in the final recommendations, will you take into account that we have consumer-owned utilities in the state that are locally controlled and have dramatically voted, democratically voted leaderships? Are they going to be subject to any new state mandates? And if so, what type of mandates? And would you be able to answer that question now, or would the stakeholders be able to answer those questions during the stakeholder process?
Thank you, Senator Thompson. Chairs and Vice Chair, if I may, the question is an excellent one. Oregon is proud to have a diversity of utility ownership structures. I think we have benefited from that diversity. Having a one-size-fits-all has never been the way to get to the best answer. In many ways, this is a democracy of ideas, and there is recognition in this report that some of the best ideas and some of the most significant achievements have come from our customer-owned utilities. In many ways, they are not subject to some of the laborious regulatory processes through which the investor-owned utilities must operate. They are, in many cases, more nimble and more responsive to their own customers. One theme that I will share is that across the design teams, there has been a chorus, if I may, for engaging our citizens, engaging consumers as more proactive partners in our energy system. Today, the way the electricity system works, the way the transportation system works, the way energy works, is that we are pretty much passive passengers as consumers, as citizens. You pay what you pay at the pump. You pay your bill when you get your electricity. There's not a whole lot that we can do to direct our energy destinies as individuals. And consistently across the design teams, there has been an interest, a desire, and proposals to engage our customers more effectively so that they can help become part of the solution rather than remaining passive parts of the problem. No entities are better suited to engage their customers than our customer-owned utilities. They are the owners and they are the customers. And this is the kind of recognition that I believe sort of sets the theme and the tone for how the energy plan goes forward. I will say that in terms of mandates for customer-owned utilities, the energy plan does not recommend much in the way of aggressive mandates. There is not, there never has been in this in the energy planning process here, the heavy-handed approach as a general philosophy. Rather, I would say there has been an open-mindedness towards piloting and demonstration, tinkering, trying to get things right before we try to reach a conclusion, a preordained conclusion about the one size that should fit all.
Okay. Follow up? This will be my last question. You mentioned the roadshow. Some of us here, maybe we were asked to be on the governor's advisory group for this 10-year energy plan. And is that where folks that have been appointed to that, like me, will be involved with the process? Because I've talked to you once about this. We met in Portland, and then this is the second time I've come to the 10-year energy plan. At what point will the advisory committee that the governor's appointed be involved in the process? I'm assuming it's a roadshow.
Yes, Senator Thompson, co-chairs and vice chair. I would I very much appreciate your persistence and enthusiasm for participating as a part of this roadshow. The roadshow schedule has not been set. It remains very much a work in progress. We have quite candidly been very focused, entirely focused on getting the work done, and have not yet dedicated much time towards setting up the roadshow. So you haven't been left out. I can assure all members of this of these committees that there has not been a schedule set in your absence. We have the discussion has been around maybe doing 4 to 5, maybe 6 different events around the state, trying to distribute them geographically. And trying to do it in a way that engages the breadth of Oregon's citizenry. And so I will certainly make sure that the governor's office is aware of your interest in this. Other members of the committee are also, I'm happy to convey that to the governor's office, as you can also convey it yourselves. I think the governor's office would be very interested in making sure that we're reaching out not, in a unilateral way, but in a cooperative way.
I'd represent Boone first.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jung, thank you very much for your hard work. I'm not quite finished. I made it all the way down to the Transportation Committee. But I'm trying to figure out how many rural people are on this. I see one from Umatilla and Maybot. Teresa Maybot, I think it was. Don't know her, but how much of a presence of rural areas are represented on these teams, and if they're by region or if there's a coastal rep or, you know, whatever. So if you could address that.
Very good. Thank you for your question, Representative Boone, co-chairs, vice chair. At the beginning, I tried to explain that the individual participants in the design teams were selected not on the basis of their organizational affiliations. I probably also should have clarified that there wasn't a geographic distribution. There was never a map or a list of stakeholders against which the design team participants were sort of measured against. Instead, I think the spirit, which I understand has been a spirit in other design team processes that have taken place under this administration, has been one of get a small handful of highly qualified people. If we got all of the best and brightest, if we got all of the smartest people in Oregon on energy in the room, it still would have been hundreds of people and unwieldy. We had to, by definition, I believe, choose people who were able to access broader networks, both professionally and geographically. I can say that the design teams, almost all of them, did invite folks in, either from other organizations or other geographies, to brief their teams on perspectives that they wanted to know more about. I take a measure of pride in this, being a relative newcomer to Oregon, I actually, off the top of my head, there are several design team members that I don't know where they are from, either professionally or geographically, but I do know, or at least I have a sense of, what they're good at, and I've been enormously impressed. That's a testament to the effectiveness that of their ability to take off their stakeholder hats. Truly, these individuals have not been advocates as much as they have been collaborators and thinkers in this process. And so I can say off the top of my head, I do know there's always a bucket of pears in the siting team meetings. I don't know who brings them in off the top of my head, but I know that there's always a bucket of pears there. I do know that there's routinely accommodation made for people who have to travel to our design team meetings, and so I can at least say that they're not all coming from the same place, that there is travel time that's always factored in as the design team schedules have been set.
Just to follow up.
Follow.
I mean, and we have a kind of a wide, diverse group up here, but I would say the rurals are weighted heavily on this team up here today. But I would like, and it sounds like there would be some time for comments, and I'm sure you'll get them, but if you look at it, and I represent a rural coastal area, and I personally am a member of an electric co-op for my power, and represent a couple of other PVs, et cetera.
Representative Boone, could you put the microphone closer to your...
Oh, I'm sorry. I moved it because I did it. But I know that they would like very much to be at the table and not just as a one-time commenter. So I'm hoping that you can take the first step toward the work in progress that I'm hearing you say that this might turn out to be, and make sure that they're invited, because if you put all those co-ops and PUDs on the map, you wouldn't even need a line of the map of Oregon. It would just make a line with its color. So thank you.
Thank you for the advice. I can say that in the roadshow sort of conversations that have happened, there is an emphasis on geographic distribution. We want to make sure that we're not running up and down the Willamette Valley. And so the geographic emphasis will be there in the roadshow as we plan that. I can also say that, consistently we have, as I said before, identified that, it is the customer-owned utilities in many, if not most, cases that have led the way in terms of engaging consumers, and that has been a very powerful theme throughout all the design team work. And we have much to learn from the customer-owned utilities on that front.
Thank you.
I would just remind the audience about cell phones, please.
Michael, I'll give you the next round of questions. You had stated in your opening question that this energy plan is decisive. Now, my question to you is, since you have not taken the show on the road, if you will, and talked to those small rural utilities and talked to larger utilities, how can this plan be decisive considering the fact that it sounds like it will have many severe mandates on these rural communities, and they haven't had input yet.
Senator Olson, co-chairs, I perhaps was misunderstood when I said decisive. I certainly did not mean to imply severe or weighty in that sense. I meant really in that context to contrast it against comprehensive. A comprehensive energy plan, which is what most states strive to accomplish, are the results of 18-month to 24-month processes that involve heavy analysis, involve a lot of hiring of consultants, a lot of data, and that is, I wanted to put in contrast to that sort of energy plan what we have been up to in the last 4 months. Our energy plan, our recommendations in this energy plan are decidedly more along the lines of directional as opposed to conclusive in their data. We have, as a priority action item in almost all the design teams, identified gaps in the data. You should not be surprised to see goals that are stated in the form of blank percent by blank year. The goal there is not to set the target, but the goal there is to begin a conversation about what a right target might be. And so in that sense, decisive is directional as opposed to severe. I think that you should not expect to see anything that is heavy-handed in its form. This has been a process that has been more informed by, ways that we want to try to emulate customer-owned utilities rather than ways we want to try to change them.
I do one short follow-up. My big concern is the fact that this is going to impact ratepayers and consumers. Have you done any fiscal analysis to determine that impact in this 10-year time plan?
Thank you very much for that question. Affordability is a given in how an energy plan must unfold, this energy plan must unfold. The nature of energy going forward, the consensus in our group, and I think the consensus among almost everyone working in energy, is that unless something changes, energy will almost certainly cost more in the future than it does today. This is driven by many macro global factors that, quite frankly, are beyond the control of any market, this particularly the size of Oregon, to affect. That said, there are some things, many things, that we can do to mitigate those price increases, to defer them, maybe even avoid them if we're lucky. And so in this context, I would encourage the committees to consider the idea that the plan will not lower the cost of energy in absolute terms necessarily, although it certainly will strive to minimize it to the extent possible. However, the greater objective is to avoid, defer, minimize the rate of increase in the cost of energy going forward for the citizens of Oregon. Energy is a drag on the economy. It is, every dollar that we spend on energy is $1 less that we can invest into our businesses and communities. We do want to keep more dollars in state. Right now we send, a preponderance of our hard-earned dollars out of state on buying energy that's imported. And we can do better than that. And I think you'll see an energy plan that reflects that.
Senator Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't here earlier, so maybe some of this I missed, but you mentioned that this was a big plan or a big change. Major program, and with that comes at some point there's going to have to be administrative rules addressing it, probably some type of legislative action. When do you think the plan would be defined enough that you can actually tell us what type of impact it might have on the general fund?
Representative Krieger, co-chairs, vice chair, the question is an excellent one. I can assure you that at this point we do not have that resolution. Most of the programs that have been described here are either programs that are already in existence but could be better coordinated, could be better aligned. There is an emphasis on taking what we're already doing and getting more bang for those bucks. That is, I believe, weighted more heavily in our set of recommendations than new programs that need to go forward. Energy, to be quite candid, the majority of dollars spent on energy are dollars that are outside of a state budget. These are private sector dollars as opposed to public sector dollars. And so we have, as a group, spent most of our attention on how do we manage the dollars coming out of people's pockets in the forms of energy bills, energy costs, and given, I guess, less attention so far at this point to what is the impact on the state revenue picture. That said, going forward, 2013, there is a lot of time between now and the 2013 legislative session. This is one of those kind of data analysis gaps that has been identified and that needs to be filled before we can have, you know, a clear sense of what the impact would be on the general fund.
That reminds me, we did the Marine Reserve issue 6-7 years, community teams up and down the coast, the OPEC process, all the stakeholders that were involved in that, and it was highly contested even to this day. So I don't know how long you've been working on this, but to move something this large that fast, I think you're going to make mistakes if you aren't very, very careful about who you engage in this, and that the people here and the people that are going to be affected really understand what you're doing and how it's going to affect them. I don't know how much your timeline is, but, you know, it took us on Marine Reserve 7 years, two governors, thousands of different meetings up and down the coast. We still could not get everybody to the table to understand and agree with what was happening.
Thank you for the advice and the caution.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been asked to channel for our chair who is out ill today, so these questions are coming to me. What does the governor hope to accomplish through the 10-year energy plan?
And just as a general...
General questions.
I would say that this energy plan should be viewed in the context of many other efforts that are underway to make Oregon a better place to live, work, and play. The baseline questions of not just affordability, but also the reliability and the accessibility and the equity issues associated with energy, I believe, are baseline. That those are things that we cannot afford to tinker with. However, as I was saying before, energy is almost certainly likely to cost more going forward, and we are trying to make recommendations that will defer, slow down, avoid those energy price increases to the extent possible. Oregon is competing. Oregon is competing against its neighboring states. It is competing against neighboring countries and the rest of the world. And that competition is relentless. The competition for clean tech is well underway. Oregon has, to its credit, a head start. Oregon, in many ways, is at the leadership of the pack when it comes to doing things, particularly on things like energy efficiency, for example. How do we accelerate from being at the front of the pack poses a particular challenge. That means you don't have a model to follow. It means you don't have someone to chase. It means you have to go faster from already being the fastest ones out there. And it's a challenge. But the energy plan that we're putting forward for the governor's consideration attempts to put Oregon in a position of accelerating from a point of leadership already. And so that in sort of a blanket statement would be my offering for what we're trying to accomplish.
Thank you. And follow up, I'm glad that you answer that way because it takes some of the questions off of my list. So can you please tell us, and knowing that the plan isn't still in the development, how we're comparing to California and Washington on their energy planning?
The Washington plan, for those of you who have seen it, focuses mostly on transportation. Our plan is, I would argue, more balanced. It takes a look at the different parts of the energy system and tries to coordinate them rather than trying to, what I believe the energy policy environment often does. The energy policy in our country in particular is often guilty of all in on renewables, or all in on biofuels, or all in, and it makes for a pretty tough way to do business. You know, we end up having policy come and go. We end up having great enthusiasm for one thing for one election cycle, and then 2 years later, the market's not there and everyone starts chasing the next thing. We are trying to be more balanced in our approach and trying not to make, all-in bets on any one particular sector or policy. California is a very different state than ours. California is much bigger for obvious reasons. The cost of energy in California is quite different. And the political climate there is also significantly different. We have not been comparing our plans to other state plans so much as we have been referencing those plans, borrowing what we think is worthy and not adopting the things that we think are not relevant to Oregon. We have consulted more broadly than just Washington and California. We have looked at British Columbia and Massachusetts. We've talked with folks in Connecticut. We've looked at the Idaho and the, I think, Montana plans. We've done our homework, and I think that our energy plan is A, more interesting, B, I believe, more balanced, and C, we got it done faster than anyone else, I can guarantee you that.
One follow-up. This one would be on the potential for job creation as well as economic development coming out of the energy plan, and which of those areas do you think shows the most potential?
Excellent question, Senator, co-chairs, vice chair. Job creation, at least in my view, is as much about retaining the jobs that we already have as it is about attracting new jobs. In my view, we should be focused on net jobs as opposed to just creating new jobs. It can be tempting, perhaps, to chase the shiny new things and create 10 jobs but lose 100 other jobs along the way. That's not what we want to accomplish in this energy plan. In terms of the greatest potential, we believe, I believe, and I think the energy plan reflects this belief, that the things that we have already done are not going to be the things that will get us to the next generation of what we want to accomplish with regard to energy. In order to get to that next generation of energy efficiency, next generation of clean technology, next generation of transportation, and to get ahead of the pack, as I was describing before, and to stay ahead of the pack, we will need to think differently. And I think a great area of promise, as I mentioned before, engaging consumers, engaging our citizens, engaging our communities, holds a tremendous problem. Technology is an area where there are, you know, the electricity system, for one example, is almost entirely built upon technologies that are 1940s, 50s, and 60s vintage. They're antiques in many ways. They're wonderful antiques. They are reliable. They're amazingly, you know, effective at what they do. But the fact of the matter is that if you were to rebuild the grid today, you probably would want to do it with newer technology than how we built it in the 1950s and 60s. That's not a critique of the utilities, but it's just kind of a fact, you know, a reflection of the nature of technological change. Applying technologies intelligently going forward, not just for the grid, but also to our transportation system, holds enormous promise. Oregon is fortunate not just because, we have a leadership position in areas like efficiency and clean technology, but also because I believe we have a population that is forward-thinking. Oregon, in many ways, is a test market for the next generation, or should become a test market for the next generation of energy products, goods, and services. And if we can make ourselves into a fertile petri dish, if you will, for that kind of innovation, to become that living laboratory, I believe we will be successful in attracting investment from companies that want to, put products out there and will begin in Oregon and maybe even call Oregon home for their corporate presences.
Thank you.
I would note for the committee that I believe some members have caucus. If any members who have caucus would like to jump in prior to leaving, Representative Witt, is that okay with you? Okay. Any other members who have to leave that would like to jump in? Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I jump in?
Please.
Thanks for all your work on this. We really appreciate it. When I hear about forward-looking it seems like that might apply more to areas that have many opportunities available to them. My part of the state is pretty well fixed in what it's been doing and isn't going to change too quickly. And some of the things that have happened in the past that I've had the opportunity to observe have been hugely expensive for people in my part of the state. Hugely expensive, and these changes, for example, bioelements in diesel fuel and other things like that, were imposed upon them and upon us. These costs are ones that don't lend themselves really to much discussion about how great it is that change has occurred. They result in how we're going to keep the doors open. And so the concept of looking forward 10 years is great, and the weighing and balancing that you're talking about is even better. But what I'm concerned about, I suppose, would be things like caps on emissions and more mandates concerning mixtures of fuel. And I probably we could get to the RPS pretty quickly. But for purpose of this question, do you anticipate a number of do you anticipate that this plan will contain a balance between new regulatory restrictions on the one hand and economic opportunity on the other? And I just want to point out one thing. In the low carbon fuel standard bill, there was an argument that somehow there would be no cost because we would attract so many businesses to this state. It would all be offset by all the wonderful things that would happen economically. I don't agree with that. And so perhaps you can address that aspect of how your plan, I'm sorry, our plan the governor's plan is going to emerge. How is it going to balance these things? And the specific thing I would like to know is the hard cap on emissions that was suggested a couple of years ago in some, I think it was Senate Bill 80.
Thank you, Representative. Co-chairs, Vice Chair. With regard to imposing costs without giving people information or choices, as a general rule, this plan has not gone down that road. As I've mentioned before, you know, engaging consumers, engaging our citizens, you can't engage citizens if you, A, don't give them information, and B, don't give them choices. You know, it's not much of an engagement if you don't have a choice in what you're being told to do. And so in my view, engaging citizens requires that we give people better information about, you know, the costs and the impacts and the ups and downs, the pros and cons of the choices that we make available to them. Right now, with most of our energy, you know, system, we don't have a choice. When you fill up your automobile, you pretty much have one choice, petroleum. If you're going to use electricity, you pretty much have one choice, on or off. It's pretty binary in its nature. It will take some effort to break that way of doing things. We have always assumed the worst about our customers in this energy world. We have assumed that, to be very candid, we have assumed that they don't care. We assume that even if they did care, they don't know better. We have assumed that even if they did know better, they probably won't do it anyway. They wouldn't be reliable. We have assumed the worst. And one of the reasons I moved to Oregon is because I assume the best about our fellow man. And I think we can do better than that. And I think Oregon can show us the way to get to a position where we can bet on our consumers to meet us halfway or better. And in doing so, unlock creativity and innovation that keeps us from having to take draconian measures that impose a one-size-fits-all.
You'd mentioned earlier that that your working group had stakeholders take their hats off and come into this with an open mind to put this plan together. And then you mentioned that the stakeholders now needed to put their hats back on to work as function as a stakeholder. Will these same stakeholders that created this plan, will they also financially benefit from this plan?
Thank you, Senator. Co-chairs. I said before that we haven't done the math on how this impacts the general fund, that we haven't gotten the analysis on many of sort of the costs and the benefits of these measures, that this is more directional than it is detailed. I think that same would be true of who are the winners and losers. I, quite frankly, even just thinking off the top of my head, there isn't an obvious answer. I think that as individuals, it goes one way. As businesses, it may go another way. As organizations, it may go another way. I can say from my gut that the calculus, we didn't have time for the calculus as individual participants. Everyone was so busy writing, reading, gathering the information and putting the plans together that I can say with full confidence that there was never much in the way of, or anything in the way of, sort of backroom wheels and deals in terms of, I'll support this measure if you support that measure in this energy plan. That was not the way we did our business, and I'm pretty confident that that calculus was not, a factor in how we reached our recommendations.
I wasn't suggesting that they were wheeling and dealing. What I was asking was these people that were the stakeholders that took their hat off, they are now back in the stakeholder market. In other words, they have an opportunity to benefit from this plan if it's instituted. And I was just wondering if, in fact, they would be able to benefit. Those people that you identified originally helping create this plan obviously work in the energy field. And my question then is, will they benefit financially from this plan if it's instituted? Or are they on the outside?
Ask for clarification.
Sure.
Because what I'm hearing the question being asked is asking something that I thought I already heard, saying there's been no final deal that we're going to take this out, so we're not sure exactly what is going to be the plan, and it seems hard to grasp how he's going to be able to answer that question until we get the feedback through the process. To me, what I understand is this is rolling out what this think tank put forward as an option, and now the individuals are going to come back in and be able to, let's say, put their interest back in play as to how it might play out in the future as compared to saying whether there's winners or losers, who's going to financially benefit without knowing what the plan actually is?
Thank you for the comment there, Senator. It is correct that what we are talking about at this point on Friday, delivered to the governor, is a proposal. A plan will be the thing that emerges at the end of the stakeholder consultation period as the governor's plan. So this is a task force proposal on Friday that will hopefully eventually evolve into a governor's plan. With regard to, you know, who will benefit and who will not, at the end of the day, I think Oregonians will benefit. Oregonians will benefit. Some may benefit more than others. Some may benefit later or sooner than others. But Oregonians will benefit. The idea that this is a zero-sum game, I think, is perhaps an incorrect one. You know, in economics, there is something called deadweight loss. Deadweight loss is money that we're just kind of leaving on the table, that no one is benefiting from. The approach that we have taken in this plan is to, let's go after that deadweight loss. Let's not rob Peter to pay Paul, but let's figure out what money we are leaving on the table and go after that and benefit the state and not really focus on how much can I get at anyone else's expense.
Thank you. Representative Witt, very patient.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Jung, my district is one of those rural ones that Representative Boone talked about earlier. In my district, consumer-owned power is a very large percentage of the market. By virtue of the fact that portions of my district are as rural as they are, one of the consumer-owned utilities has one of the highest electrical rates in the nation. Side by side, interestingly enough, with another consumer-owned utility that generates one of the lowest electrical rates in the United States. Back in the 30s, one of the challenges that made electricity possible to much of my district was rural electrification, and that made electricity possible. One of the challenges today is to make that electricity affordable to everyone. It's simply incomprehensible to me and to most of the ratepayers in my district, who oftentimes are 10 miles separated, that one household has the cheapest power rates in the nation and the other the most expensive. And so you were talking about the leadership that the 10-year plan was looking at presenting, and I'm wondering if that encompasses making electricity affordable to rural Oregonians.
Thank you, Representative Co-Chair Bailey and Vice Chair Olson. The situation you have described, I think, reflects the reality, which is that our choices matter. Our choices matter. I'm not sure that the exact circumstances that, you know, led these two utilities to what looks sounds like quite different outcomes, but it does sound like they probably made some different choices along the way, and as a result are facing very different presents, which a long time ago were futures. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Jung, unfortunately, it was one of those circumstances that you described earlier as a lack of choice. I think if you, to paraphrase the director of the consumer-owned utility, the reason our rates are so high is because no one else would ever even consider stringing a line in that area. It's so rural. So I have a considerable area in my district where high power rates lead to uncompetitiveness, non-competitiveness in terms of being able to even function in the year 2012. There are very few business opportunities when your energy costs are that high, and on and on and on and on and on. And so as opposed to the challenge in the Great Depression of providing that power, the challenge now is how do we make it affordable so that everyone can be a participant in today's society, both socially and economically.
Thank you for the explanation. I will agree that rural electrification was a remarkable achievement that brought energy to places that previously were dark. I grew up in Kentucky myself, down one of those little hollers where we wouldn't have had electricity if the Rural Electrification Administration hadn't come in and done its job. So I'm a firsthand product of some of that good work. Will Oregon, through this 10-year plan, make electricity affordable for everyone? I can't say that it will even out the disparity that you've described. I can't say that we will put in one price for the entire state or for all of its customers. I will say that from a big picture perspective, the biggest drivers for the cost of energy going forward is going to be the fact that our hydro resources, which have been abundant, going forward are limited. From an electricity perspective, we don't have the option for nuclear power in the state. It's banned. Coal power increasingly has problems, and we know that Boardman plant, the last coal-fired generator in the state of size, is scheduled to be out of service in 2020. That leaves us relatively few options, and so really the challenge here is to make sure that we get the most out of the assets that we have, that we find the best way to utilize resources that are variable, renewable, intermittent renewable generation, because if we don't integrate them cleverly, we will pay for both the renewable plant and the gas peaking plant that sits behind it to firm it as a resource. I'm personally not a big fan of paying twice for the same resource if I don't have to. And increasingly, it looks like there are technologies, business models, ways to engage the system in ways that, you know, perhaps can mitigate the need for paying twice for the same power.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
One more quick question. You mentioned hydro power. Will the governor's 10-year energy plan count hydroelectricity as a renewable?
Hydropower is recognized in our plan as being a tremendous asset. It is one of the reasons that Oregon is as affordable as it is from an energy perspective, as reliable as it is from an energy perspective. The general consensus going forward is that new hydro does not appear to have large potential for powering supplies going forward. And so not much emphasis has been placed on should we treat new hydro. There may be some discussion on relicensing hydro and how do we treat that or how might we approach that. But in terms of new hydro, we are not really looking at, in this plan, new hydro as a very large resource to meet demand going forward.
I apologize. We have floor at 3 o'clock to do some serious state business, so I will close the committee meeting from Environment and Natural Resources. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Members, if you mind staying just a little bit longer. Thank you, Senators. Further questions from this side? Representative Boone.
Thank you. And I'm glad Senator Thompson asked that question. A great lead into my comment. Mr. Jung, I guess I would have to respectfully disagree with you on the hydro question. If you look at BC's RPS, they do count their hydro as renewable, so they're up in the 90 percentile range. I also believe that Oregon has tremendous opportunities for tidal power and wave power. So I think that we can comfortably look, and those are both very reliable sources. They would be 24/7.
I'm sorry if I didn't clarify that. In my thinking, hydropower, I think of dams, and with wave power and tidal power, that is to me an emerging, a new, exciting technology that I think of differently as hydropower. So okay. It is all water in the end. I would agree.
Yeah, but I do follow. I do personally agree with counting hydro as renewable because it is, and I understand the. I know because I was part of that conversation early on. When somebody picked, I don't even know how that happened. That I sure would like, if anybody in the room knows how that year was picked, where anything after 1993 or 4 was considered not, or that would be the renewable part, but anything before that was not renewable. So,
sounds like further discussion on another topic. We'll stay focused on the plan here, but we can follow up, I'm sure, on that. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Jung, could you give us any insight as to how the 10-year plan envisions keeping energy costs in Oregon regionally competitive?
It's a very broad question, Representative Co-Chair Bailey. Do you have a specific area that you're curious about? I can go on at length on this, and I don't want to take up your entire afternoon, I'm afraid.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. More specifically, with respect to our renewable energy standards.
Thank you for the clarification, Representative Trevelli. The nature of renewable power, particularly wind and solar resources that tend to be the dominant options at this point in time, are that they are variable. They are intermittent. And wind, in general, tends not to follow the times when we need electricity the most. In many cases, in many parts of the country, wind blows most strongly at night, and that is off-peak from an electricity demand perspective. Presently, there is not a whole lot in the way of cost-effective energy storage. And in many parts of the country, wind power, which is the vast preponderance of renewables as we're talking about it, is priced negatively. They actually would pay someone to take the power if they could, in other words, because it's coming on at the wrong time. A particularly interesting and I think exciting opportunity comes with, as we start to see enthusiasm build around electric vehicles, even if they're not deployed at large number yet, as we look at, you know, there are people buying them, and it's a double-edged sword. From an energy perspective, there are basically batteries on wheels. But if you were to have a cul-de-sac of neighbors who all decided that they wanted to be, you know, catch up with the Joneses, and they all bought electric vehicles, and they all rolled home at around 6 p.m. and plugged in their electric vehicles, started taking charge. They walked in, turned on the lights, flipped on the TV, turned on the kitchen, got the air conditioning going. Kids are home from school, but maybe some people are still at work. That is the worst possible time, and we would have to overbuild the grid in order to meet those kind of that new peak that's introduced by an electric vehicle. A double-edged sword, though. If we were able to take that same electric vehicle and have it absorb excess wind generation at off-peak hours, mm-hmm. you could conceivably be paid to charge your car. And that helps us not only to avoid spilling a resource that otherwise we can use, but it also, if the vehicle, and this is further out in the future, I will clarify, if the vehicle is able to talk back to the grid, what we call vehicle-to-grid, and provide services back to the grid where there's set, you know, voltage regulation, frequency regulation, even the energy, electrons, back to the grid. You know, in electricity, we talk about what we call a load-following resource. Your electric vehicle is the ultimate load-following resource. It literally follows you. You're the load, and it follows you, and it's a resource. It goes with you to work. It goes back home with you, you know, at the end of the day. It's where the energy consumption tends to be. And if we can set ourselves up so that we can, you know, make the most of these resources, that's the kind of thing that helps us to avoid overbuilding the grid for the worst-case scenarios.
Thank you.
Mr. Jung, I'm curious to ask, as Oregon has structured previous efforts on energy in the Business Energy Tax Credit and in the new iterations of their Energy Incentive Program, in the RPS, in the Energy Efficiency Sustainable Technology Act, Governor's Cool Schools Program, there's been an integral connection between job creation and our energy future. And I think a very, very clearly demonstrated link that this state is making an investment in energy and next generation energy, both in terms of energy generation and energy efficiency, in order to give Oregon an economic edge as well as an energy edge. You spoke a little bit about the distinction between retained jobs, new jobs, but I'm hoping that you could articulate a little bit more broadly. Is the purpose of the 10-year energy plan just energy, or is it energy and economic development?
Thank you for the question, Co-Chair Bailey. The bottom line is jobs. The bottom line is that we could do all the right things on energy, but if there's no one left living in Oregon because they can't get a job here, it will all have been for naught. In fact, it turns out that the more people come to Oregon to live, work, and play, the more broad a base we can allocate those costs across. And it becomes a virtuous circle, if that makes sense. In terms of the specifics, what you've described, and I was not privy to the history of a lot of what you've described, being a relative newcomer to the state, what you've described sounds like, at least from what I've heard, relatively targeted, focused pieces of legislation or programs that were narrowly defined. This energy plan is anything but narrow. It is trying to be balanced across the breadth of energy, and energy is, it's the oxygen of the modern economy. You can't do anything today without energy. And so to try to look at energy in the four-month period that we've had has taken up all of the available time just to get those proposals together. I can assure you that if we get it right, then it sets the stage with linkages to education, linkages to workforce and training. It sets the stage for the fact that we will always need energy, and we will always have an environment in which we must live. We will always have, you know, communities that we have to, you know, support and call home. And if we can do it right, we can link those three together in ways that work together. The energy plan does not have specific numbers on if we do this measure, it will create XYZ number of jobs. If we do that measure, it will create ABC number of jobs. We're not down to that level of resolution. I will say, though, that energy is the mother of all markets. There is money looking for a place to call home, investment that has to take place someplace, and that investment is looking for the right place. If we get energy policy right in the state of Oregon, if we build it, they will come. It sounds like a leap of faith. It would be a leap of faith if it were not the case that there is money looking for energy, or energy money looking for a place to call home. I work for a company called Silver Spring Networks. It's a Silicon Valley high-tech company. In the little road that Silver Spring Networks calls home, there's three other clean tech companies, all, you know, booming. They are chasing markets. They are winning deals. They are growing. If you were down in Silicon Valley, you wouldn't know that there were a recession on. The clean tech activity is that exciting. But those companies, you know, they're in California just because that's where the entrepreneurialism lies. It's not necessarily the place where they can scale and grow. They need to scale and grow in markets where people understand their products, goods, and services, where the policies are supportive. And California is not the only place for that. Oregon can be a fantastic place for that, too. And that's the kind of environment we're trying to set here with the energy plan.
Thank you. I think that's probably a very good summary of where we're at, and I think we'll leave it there. Thank you, Mr. Jung, for your time and your willingness to come before both committees and answer the questions. Committee, thank you for your thoughtful questions and for staying late.
Thank you. And if I may add to the record, to the extent that my travels around the state enable it to happen, I would love to visit. I would love to go out and see firsthand your communities, to meet your constituents, to get a sense of what it is like every place in Oregon, because an energy plan needs to work for everyone in Oregon, not just the select few.
Appreciate the offer. Thank you, committee. We are adjourned.
Thank you.